So our welcome to Tesnua. Our speaker today is Jim from Hong Kong. I attend the meeting in Hong Kong every now and then. It's always good to get a step ahead of what's happening here on this side of the planet. So runs a good meeting, and I'm looking forward to hearing about your journey. So Jim, it's all yours. There's no time limit, so talk away. And that's it. It's all. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me, Marcia. My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. And I guess just to start out, cover some of the basics. My sobriety date is March 3rd of 2018. So I've been sober for, I looked on my app this morning when Marcia asked me my sobriety date. I knew my sobriety date, but wanted to look at it's 4 months, 4 years, 4 months, and 16 days. I think it said it, I might 1599 days. So tomorrow will be 1600 days. Anyway, one day at a time. So that's my sobriety date, 2018, March. But that's not when I started trying to get sober. That's not my first AA meeting date. That's not my first recovery type program that I ever went to. My first AA meeting was on July 13th of 2016 in New York City. I was home for my annual visit, and this one was extra special because I was getting a knee replacement. Because of many of the falls and accidents I had while drunk. My first attempt at, I guess, a formalized recovery was in September of 2009 when my boss, threatened me with my job. And I went to the Addiction Institute of New York, which at the time was at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital, now called Mount Sinai West Hospital. And I was in that program for about 6 months. And they offered two styles of programs. They offered a moderation management program or an abstinence program. And being at the time, I didn't really identify as alcoholic, but being a problem drinker who knew I was in trouble from my drinking, all I wanted to do was learn how to drink responsibly. So I chose moderation management. I certainly didn't want to abstain from alcohol. Alcohol was important to me. So I went to that program for about 6 months, and I graduated. I received a certificate that says I successfully completed the New York Addiction Institute's program of moderation management. But the thing is, I bullshitted my way through that program for the 6 months that I was in it. It was certainly not honest at all. And yeah. But before that, I guess really as early as 2003 is when I think my problem really kicked off, where I could see, to myself, I could say to myself, wait a minute, like Jim, you used to drink every night after work, but now you're drinking during the day because I wasn't working. I was in between jobs, and that time, there was a downturn in my industry, and there was a layoff, and I received this wonderful severance payment and all that kind of good stuff, but I had lots of time on my hands, and all of a sudden I'm drinking all the time during the day for no reason at all. And I used to think my drinking was because I needed to drink after work. That's why I drink. I need to drink after work to like deal with the stress, deal with all the idiots that I had to work with. That type of stuff, you know. But now I'm drinking like just a drink and I'm like, wow, what's going on? But, you know, that's all I did. It just kind of registered up here a little bit. And then over the course of 2003 to 2006, you know, it just progressed more and more, and to the point where 2006, I was going back to work in a high powered job in New York City. And I was talking with the person that was going to be my boss, and we had met at a hotel bar to have a drink and chat about what it was going to be like to work again together, because we had worked previously together back in the 90s. And I went to pick up a drink that I had ordered. I was trying to have cut back so that I, you know, was clear-headed for this kind of chit-chat, not really an interview. It was kind of the job was a done deal. But I went to reach for that drink on the table and with my right arm. And I was like shaking like this, you know, and I was like, holy shit, what's going on? And I had to literally reach out with my other hand and control my arm and pick up my drink and bring it to my mouth. And my soon to be boss said, what's wrong with you? And I said, I've got an injury in my neck and it's causing me spasms in my arm. And I, you know, it's like, I'm going to see a specialist. They're going to take care of it. You know, just more bullshit, you know. Anyway, that's the last job I ever held. I was in that job from 2006 to 2010. That was the boss that gave me the ultimatum in 2009 to do something about my drinking or else. And that's when I went to the moderation management program for 6 months and thought, I graduated. I'm good. So, yeah, that's kind of my just a big picture of the beginning of my recovery journey. Realization in 2003 that my drinking's not what I thought it used to be. And then 2006, 3 years later, realizing, wow, I can't even control my hand when I've cut back on the alcohol consumption. You know, I've got the shakes. And then almost 4 years of working back in the industry in New York that I was in a high pressure job, spiraling out of control to the point where finally an ultimatum about losing my job by my boss. In 2009, and then losing that job in 2010, getting fired. You know, of course, the words "we're firing you because you're an alcoholic" weren't used, but there was a downsizing, and my job was being consolidated and eliminated and combined with another position. So it was a job elimination, was the official terminology. And of course, you know, they also sweetened that by paying me off out of my contract. So, you know, that helped my alcoholic mind soothe myself a lot about that too, you know. But we'll leave it there for that. And let's go way back to the very beginning. Since you've given me an open book as far as how long I can share. Do we have 5 hours? No, just kidding. So I'm American. I was born in the Midwest of the United States in a city called St. Louis. Yes, that's named after a saint, St. Louis of France, Catholic. And I was brought up in the Roman Catholic Church by a very devout mother. On my father's side, not so much. Christian, I guess you would say, but no particular sect that they followed. On my mother's side, it was a different story. So a typical kind of middle class U.S. Midwestern family. One brother, mother, father, brick house, two cars in the garage, front lawn, backyard with a fence, that type of existence. When I was a little kid, at first, I led what I felt was an idyllic life. I think most of us probably did. There are exceptions, I know that. But somewhere, I don't know, around 6 or 7 years old, I became aware that my life wasn't so idyllic and that I was kind of living at home in a tornado all of a sudden because my parents started fighting. And that's when I would say my life went from being idyllic to very fearful because, I didn't like that, of course, watching my mom and dad fight verbally at first, but over time it advanced to more serious fighting. And so as a little 6 or 7 year old, you know, I used to try to run away from that. And when I was that small, I would just like hide down in the basement of our home amongst the boxes of, you know, stuff packed away and create like a little protective fort and put my fingers in my ears and sing myself a little song or something so that I couldn't hear the screaming going on upstairs and then all the racket. You know, and as I got a little bit older and this all continued, you know, and I could like jump on my bike and ride off, I would do that. I'd spend the whole day, you know, away, especially when mom and dad were home on the weekends and they were fighting. I'd spend the whole day out of the house, you know, on my bicycle with my brother or with my friends and, you know, come back as dusk settled in and the street lights came on and hoping that the tornado that was my family life now had settled down for the evening and we could turn on the TV and watch, you know, Disney's, you know, what was that called? Disney's, not the, whatever, you get the idea. We were, you know, we had all those late 1960s, early 1970s programs on the TV at night. Wild Kingdom. Oh, that's the one. Wild Kingdom. I love that show. The fear in the household grew and grew because my father got progressively more violent. So he went from just verbally assaulting my mother to his next move was to spit on her. I guess he felt that that showed his absolute disgust for her. And so during the argument, you know, he'd make his point by spitting on her. And then the spitting led to shoving. And then the shoving led to falling, you know, being pushed over the coffee table or down the steps, that type of thing. I do remember one time for sure that the police came to our house and my dad was taken away in handcuffs. But he came back really fairly quickly. I can't remember if it was later that same day or night or the next day, but he came back really quickly and all he was really pissed, just really pissed that she had called the cops and that they had taken him away. I was a bundle of nerves as a kid like that with dealing with that. Then I started hearing the divorce and separation language, right? And that was even more fearful, like, what's going to happen to me? What's going to, you know, am I going to be, you know, like, what, you know, I was not stupid. I had seen things on TV about divorce. I hadn't experienced any of that in my own life with any of my friends. Everybody that I hung out with, it was like I said, I St. Louis is a Catholic city. One of the first questions you'd get asked in St. Louis is, what parish do you belong to? You know, that was your identifier. It was like, it kind of identified your socioeconomic situation too, depending on what parish you belong to. And divorce just wasn't a thing, at least not that I knew. So, you know, I'm thinking to myself, where am I going to live? What school am I going to go to? What, you know, what about my friends? So it was fear, and it was all me, me, me. What's, you know, what's going to go on with me? And so anyway, they did separate, they did divorce. And then another big hole happened, so to speak. My dad just kind of skipped town. He actually fought for custody at first, but then when he lost, he just skipped town. And I don't know. I just couldn't understand that. Not only did he skip town, he started skipping child support payments. So my mother, who hadn't worked as a married woman, she worked before she got married, but she hadn't worked. She was a housewife and a mother, bringing up two kids, doing all the usual stuff, taking care of the house, cooking, cleaning, washing clothes, packing lunches, you know, playing, you know, chauffeur to different events, you know, whatever. She's now a single mother and, you know, trying to support two kids, wanting to continue to send us to Catholic private schools for the rest of our education through elementary school and then into high school. And, you know, now the money's cut off from child support, and she's doing a pretty basic clerical job at a Catholic insurance company associated with our parish. And, you know, so just more fear and more anger and resentment, you know, totally toward my dad, that's for sure. About like, why did he do this? Why did he run away? And he moved out to LA. I'm like, I didn't even know we knew anybody that lived out on the West Coast. Like, it's like, why? How would he end out on the West Coast? We're Midwestern people. All of our family kind of is in the generalized area of the Midwest of the U.S. And yeah, so, you know, then now I've got fears about, you know, am I going to continue in school? And then my mother was insistent that we continue on with private education in the Catholic school system. And so that meant I had to get an after school job and then also a summer job working at the school and to help pay the tuition. And I was just like, wow, you know, what happened? All of a sudden, my life is just completely upended. And, you know, I was envious and jealous of other kids because, you know, they weren't working after school. They weren't working their whole summer break to pay their tuition at this private school. As I got into high school, you know, they had cars, they were driving already. My mother was still driving the old beat up car that she got in the divorce settlement, you know, and, so the next big trauma in my life came when I was just out of high school, starting into college, university. And I realized, I had realized this for quite a while, but of course didn't say anything and kept it a big secret. I realized I was gay. And so I was dealing with a lot of fear around that too. You know, certainly wasn't revealing it, especially once I was in high school. And so basically I went into the avoidance technique there with not going to school dances and anything like that that would make me have to socialize with the opposite sex and, you know, bring a date or anything like that. And so I became a little bit, you know, I would say reclusive during high school because of that, and secretive. And while this you know, coming to terms with my sexuality was happening, I met an older guy who was gay, who was a teacher at the school, and who kind of took me under his wing. And my mother actually encouraged the relationship from the standpoint of she felt I needed a male figure in my life, a father figure, so to speak, since my own father was absent out in California. And so this teacher started taking me to cultural events, museums, the symphony, cultural type movies and things like that, out to dinner, to fancy restaurants and things. And over the course of time, that became an actual relationship, and eventually a sexual relationship. And he's the person that introduced me really to alcohol. And this is where alcohol comes into my story. And it progresses really quickly from there because, I was seduced by the allure of the alcohol that he seemed to enjoy in a reasonable way. You know, we would go out to dinner, we would have a cocktail before dinner, we would have a glass of wine with dinner, we would have an after dinner drink like a brandy or something. You know, this was all new to me. I mean, my family did not really drink at all. I mean, I maybe would have had a sip of my dad's beer in the backyard during a barbecue when I was a little kid or something. But this was really my introduction to alcohol and drinking like a gentleman, like it says in the big book. And I just took to it like, you know, a fish to water, I guess you would say. And, but, you know, when I had my first real drink like that, that feeling, I don't know, it was different to me. I just, I felt like it was a magic elixir. And it relaxed me. It made me feel more confident. I felt more at ease to be able to talk and share my thoughts and feelings. And that just set off a course for me for the rest of my life. And once my mother found out about this relationship, that it was not just a father-like, you know, mentoring situation, that it had turned into much more than that, and I came out to her as gay, she gave me an ultimatum. I was 17 going on 18, and I was a freshman, just finishing my freshman year of university, and I got that, you know, you're living in my house, young man. You're going to live by my rules. You cannot be gay. You know, you are sinning. You are a sinner. You need to go to our parish priest and confess your sins and never do this again. This is a mortal sin you're committing. And then to top that off, you need to go see our family doctor because you are mentally ill. You need to talk to a psychiatrist. He can recommend somebody for you to speak to be cured of this mental disease. And I was like, Mom, this is who I am. I don't view it as a sin, nor do I view it as a disease, a mental disease, being gay. Anyway, so the ultimatum was put to fruition, and she threw me out And she was able to, she knew I was 17, not quite 18, so she couldn't just throw me out on the street by the laws of Missouri. So she was able to track down my father, and she bought me a plane ticket, and she sent me out to California, to Los Angeles, to spend the summer with him, under the auspices that I'd think about whether I was really gay or not, and whether I, when I came back, I'd submit to her demands and go confess my sins and get myself cured. Well, when I got out to LA, my dad picked me up at the airport, who, you know, I felt like a stranger to. I mean, you know, I got a card from him, like for Christmas and my birthday, and that was about it. I had seen him like one time since he left St. Louis at a family reunion, you know, over the course of like a 2-day weekend, and that was it. So I'm sitting in the car with, you know, almost feels like an absolute stranger. And he's, you know, angry. Like, what the hell has happened that your mother has tracked me down and has sent you out here to spend the summer with me? And, you know, so I came out to him in the car on the way from LAX to where he lived. And to my surprise, sort of, because I had kind of heard some stuff from my older brother, but I wasn't sure I wanted to believe it. Anyway, my dad sitting next to me, after I come out to him, turns to me as he's driving and says, well, I have something to tell you too. I'm gay. And, you know, the whole reason I left St. Louis and came out to the West Coast is because of my partner that I was with. And, you know, and I basically started a new life. The life that I didn't get to have when I was forced to marry your mother and lead a life that I, you know, didn't want to leave, lead and have kids that I didn't really want to have. And needless to say, that was an interesting summer we spent together. There were funny moments of it, going to gay bars together. And I remember one instance in particular where we were at a bar called the Toy Tiger in Los Angeles. And an entertainer named Rudy DeLamar was playing the piano. It was a piano bar. He dressed as a woman from the waist up and a man from the waist down. He, and he sang songs, and people sang along, but then he also did like a comedy routine in between. And a big part of his comedy routine was picking on people in the audience. And at this one time when we were there, he lasered his eyes in on me and my dad standing together, and he started making the daddy son jokes that will often happens in the gay community about an older man with a younger man. And my dad was getting embarrassed, and he was trying to explain, no, no, you don't understand. This is my son. This is really my biological son. And Rudy was like, laughing and joking, and, you know, oh, sure it is, daddy. Yeah. Anyway, and one other funny story about that is my dad introduced me to a guy that I ended up dating for a while that he knew at a country western bar that he used to go to called Oil Can Harry's. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting to have your dad set you up with a boyfriend for a while. But, you know, alcohol just continued as part of my life out there. You know, when I came back to St. Louis, I hadn't changed my mind about who I was and what I wanted in my life. I wanted to be me. I didn't want to live a lie. After seeing why my father abandoned my brother and myself and went out to the West Coast and kind of disappeared, I was like, I certainly don't want to be like that. I don't want to live a lie. you know, get married, have kids that I don't want, and then abandon them, you know? So I, of course, made the decision that, you know, I couldn't live there with my mother. So I was 18 now. And so she said, get out, you know. The teacher mentor friend of mine that I was in the relationship with helped me to get situated living on campus with some emergency housing provided by the social services department of the university. And more pressure though. And now I'm putting myself through university on my own with loans and work study program. But at the same time, alcohol now took even more of a focus because now I'm openly gay. I've got friends I can be honest and open with. We start going to bars. Now I start not so much drinking like a gentleman, like I was taught by my mentor. I start partying, you know, binge drinking too. And that goes on through all the rest of college, university, and I graduate and I get a job. And that's when my like daily drinking for the need of decompressing started and continued for the next 35 years. And so that, you know, that pretty much, you know, is the story of my alcohol use. You know, that 35 years of daily drinking took, you know, at first was fine. You know, I was performing well, getting promoted, moving up the ladder, jumping from one prestigious company to the next, you know, got myself in, out of St. Louis to New York City. You know, what a dream for a Midwestern boy. Now to be living in New York and working at a very prominent company and playing at that lifestyle of jetting around the country and the world on business, you know, drinking on the plane, drinking in the lounges, drinking after work, drinking at work client dinners, drinking every day. And especially at the end of the day when I felt I needed to relax. And like I said, that gets to the point where it does start affecting my job eventually. And I received that ultimatum finally that I talked about at the beginning of this session. And so let me just talk then now. I think pretty much covers the drunkalogue. I mean, this latter part of the story that really brought me into recovery in AA is actually, and after the Addiction Institute little stint for 6 months is when really things got bad, really bad. Like the, you know, the comment is this is a progressive disease. And my story definitely reflects that. Once I admitted I had some type of problem, which is what I did with the Addiction Institute, I was a problem drinker and I needed to manage my drinking. That started me into lying and hiding my drinking. So that's how I was managing my drinking. I was lying about it and I was hiding it. And yes, it did make me cut down to some extent because I wasn't as free to drink like I used to be. I was still, you know, drinking a lot more than a normal person. Once I started injuring myself as time went along with some of these drunken falls and my body started reacting because it couldn't process the liquor anymore because unbeknownst to me at first, I was starting to do damage to my liver and my kidneys from my excessive alcohol consumption over these many decades now. I started having blackouts and like I said, I was injuring myself and that is what eventually led me to AA and my first AA meeting in July of 2016, because as I had said, I had flown home to New York to have a knee replacement. I was living in Shanghai at the time. How did I get to Shanghai? In the course of all of this, in my career in New York, I met someone, kind of an idyllic little scenario. We met at Gay Pride 2000 in New York City, and we've been together ever since. So 2002, sorry, Gay Pride 2002. So we just celebrated 20 years together. I was at the peak of my career when we met in 2002. He was just beginning his career. We're about 10 years apart. As I went downhill, he went uphill. I was going downhill because of my drinking and how it was affecting my career. And he was going uphill because he was an up-and-coming architect in New York City, designing some prominent hotels in the city. Eventually, he got recruited to move to China and work for a company. At that point, my career had imploded because of my alcohol use. That's, as I said, when the boss that gave me the ultimatum to do something about my drinking basically fired me 6 months later after I had graduated. It was kind of ironic that, Addiction Institute told me I had successfully completed the moderation management program, yet my boss said, things have not gotten better. And I'm sorry, but, we're going to have to eliminate your job through a downsizing and a consolidation. But here's some money to ease the pain. So at that point, we took up the offer for him to take a position in China and move to Shanghai. Through the whole time I was living in Shanghai, I wasn't working. And again, the same scenario as I had said before, like the daily drinking turned into, day and nightly drinking. Like I was just drinking all day while he was at work and sitting there thinking about throwing myself off the balcony to kill myself because I just didn't know what to do about it. And all these crazy things I was doing. His parents came to visit and he had to go away on a business trip to Beijing while they were staying with us. And I was nervous that they were staying with us to begin with. So I was drinking on the sly even more. And one night I went out and was drinking and came back and I blacked out in the elevator. And the security people in the building complex found me up, going up and down on the floor of the elevator. And, realized who I was and what apartment I belonged to and knocked on the door only to have, his parents open it up and, have their drunk, passed out, blacked out son-in-law put into the apartment and said, he belongs here, take care of him. Like those kind of incredibly embarrassing moments. But like I said, the medical issues just kept getting worse. I was finally told by a liver specialist that my liver was having serious issues. They started doing tests on me. At first it was an enlarged liver and a fatty liver. Then they actually did a biopsy on me and I had the beginnings of cirrhosis of the liver. I wasn't thinking clearly. I wasn't functioning properly. And I couldn't keep food down. I couldn't walk straight, even when I was semi-sober. I was having, like I said, these falls, eventually damaged my left knee so much it had to be replaced. Went back to New York to have that done. And I thought at my wit's end, and I decided to either check myself into a rehab or maybe go to AA. I had been told about AA a lot, but I never wanted to go to AA because I had heard that a lot of it involved the word God. And I didn't want anything to do with that. I didn't, you know, my mother rejected me because of her devout Catholic religious beliefs. And, I had very, very little to do with her for the longest time once I was out of living at home. We didn't talk for one stretch for 6 or 8 years, I think it was. Six years. 6 years we didn't even speak any way, shape, or form. Zero contact. So anyway, I decided that I'd try AA first before I'd try an inpatient rehab type situation. So I went to AA. The way I did it was by calling the New York Intergroup hotline. And I spoke to a guy for about 45 minutes on the hotline. He kind of asked, some questions, was very kind, gentle, patient. And eventually we figured out that I was gay. Well, he figured out that I was gay and I figured out he was gay. And he's like, we have LGBTQ meetings. Would you like to maybe go to one of those as your first AA meeting? Maybe you'll feel more comfortable if you're, in a community that supports you like that. And I said, sure. And he's like, well, there's a beginners meeting, an LGBTQ group called Lambda West that's very close to where you live. Why don't you go to that? And so that's what I did. And that was my first AA meeting, July 13th, 2016. And I've always been the kind of person that, like, if I'm going to commit to something, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it all the way. So I went to that beginners meeting. They stressed temporary sponsorship. So I got myself a temporary sponsor that first night at my first AA meeting. And he talked to me about the things he expected from me, to call him every day. If I don't get him, leave a voicemail. Don't just text. Go to a meeting every day for the next 90 days, more if I can, since I wasn't working. He gave me the book Living Sober to read. He said, we'll meet in a week and we're going to talk about what you read. And review it, and then we're going to start into the big book. He wanted me to get numbers of other fellows in the program and call in and check in with them every day too, not just with him. And I was doing all that, but I was still drinking. I was cutting back, trying, but lying. My sponsor says that trying is just lying. And that's what I was doing. I was going to meetings and claiming 5 days sober or 12 days sober, when in fact I had had some type of a drink or two at some point that day or the day before, to just kind of like keep me going. I felt I needed it to keep me going. So I lived that lie for about 6 weeks in AA until I went back to Shanghai, where I was living, enjoying the fellowship there, got myself a sponsor there who was an atheist. First time, like when I was in New York and went to that first meeting, I wasn't even thinking that way. But by the time I got to Shanghai, back to Shanghai, after that 6 weeks in New York working with that first sponsor, you know, after we read Living Sober and then moved on to the big book and did step one, he started in on step two with me. And I immediately started, you know, having negative pushback about this higher power, power greater than, God of your own understanding thing. And so, you know, I was kind of thankful when I had to leave and go back to Shanghai. So when I got to Shanghai and I discovered that there was this atheist guy in the Shanghai Fellowship, I was like, I listened to him in meetings for about 2 weeks. And I thought, yeah, I want what he has. He's sober and he's doing it in a way that doesn't involve any kind of, you know, God or higher power, I thought. You know, certainly nothing to do with religion. And so I started working with him. And we didn't get very far. You know, I was doing the same, trying but lying. Working the program, so to speak, outwardly, making a good show of it. But, you know, we got to step two and three, and his advice on those steps were, well, let's just kind of skip over those. Let's kind of fake it through those until you make it. And he just had me start right in on a step four inventory. And that was a disaster. I relapsed like within an hour of sitting down at my desk, starting to write out my resentments list. You know, number one at the top. I think I number one at the top, I wrote my mother, and then my dad, and then just went down the list. My brother, my aunt, my uncle, the Catholic Church, my school teachers, father so-and-so, sister so-and-so, on and on and on. Anyway, and, you know, after about an hour, I, you know, pushed the fuck it button. Can we curse here? Pushed the fuck it button and went down to the Family Mart that is like a 7-Eleven in China, and bought about my usual bottle of Smirnoff. And got drunk, you know, because that's how, what I knew. That's how I knew to deal with life, was get drunk. You know, when I was a kid, I escaped by running away, getting away from my parents arguing, hiding in the basement or riding my bike all day long outside the house. That's how I escaped. That's how I got away from my fears and my resentment, my anger, and my, yeah. And now, you know, it was, you know, run away by getting drunk. Don't deal. I can't deal. Can't deal with this stuff. So I'm just going to escape and black out. So after about 6 months, my partner, his career continuing to go upward, my career dead stop, and my life heading completely into unmanageability. And actually my liver doctor telling me, you know, listen, you know, I can tell you haven't stopped drinking. Your liver levels would be adjusting themselves if you had. So, you know, you can lie to others, but you can't lie to me. You're going to be dead if you keep drinking. So my partner got an offer with another company to move here to Hong Kong. And that's how I ended up here. And I joined the fellowship here. You know, that's the only thing I did right, I guess you could say, is I kept coming back. I didn't give up. I was persistent. I knew deep down I had a problem and I wanted to do something about it. I just didn't know what and how. And the idea of giving up alcohol completely just frightened the hell out of me. I mean, alcohol was like my best friend. It was there every time I needed it. Every pain, every sorrow, every fear, every anxiety that I went through, I reached out for it and it was there. So I just, the concept of giving it up completely just frightened the hell out of me. And we got here to Hong Kong, joined into the fellowship here right away. I waited a little longer to get a sponsor this time, listening around for people who had what I thought was sobriety that I wanted. And I also got a theory, like my first sponsor, my temporary sponsor, he was about 6 years sober, and he had sponsored people before. My second sponsor in Shanghai, he was 3 years sober, and he had never sponsored anybody when he sponsored me. And so I thought to myself here in Hong Kong, well, I'm going to look for somebody maybe who's got a ton of sobriety and has sponsored a ton of people. Maybe that's the key to this. So I picked this guy, Billy. Billy's a legend here. He's now got 41 years of sobriety. And, you know, he's sponsored a lot of people over the years, and he's seen a lot of things, and he's done a lot of things. And, so I asked him to be my sponsor. And that was August of 2017. And we started working together. But by December of 2017, I knew that it didn't matter. It didn't matter who my sponsor was, how many years my sobriety my sponsor had, how many people they had sponsored before. I needed something more. And so I did decide, after working with him from August to December, after having another horrific stint with injuring myself and getting into the hospital, I decided to go to an inpatient rehab program. And I went to one in Chiang Mai, Thailand, and I was there for 3 months. And it was a program specifically, a section of a rehab specifically for the LGBTQ community. And when I got ready to leave from there, I knew I wasn't ready. I knew I wasn't ready to leave. But my insurance company told me I was ready to leave. And I wasn't willing to foot the rest of the bill myself to stay longer. And so I left there after 3 months with a chip on my shoulder, a resentment about the fact that I didn't get to finish what I went there to do. And and that was the longest period ever in my life since I was, you know, introduced to alcohol. That was the longest period in my life, that 3 months that I didn't have a drink. But, you know, so I wasn't craving alcohol when I got out of there that day after 3 months, but I was obsessing about it still, in the sense that I knew that it would soothe these horrible feelings I had about my insurance company and about the fact that I didn't get to finish my program of recovery at this rehab. And so I got to the airport and I decided to get drunk to soothe my feelings, you know, to quell my anger and my anxiety over this whole situation that I was put into. It was thrust upon me. I didn't have anything to do with this. You know, I'm the victim here. So drank at the airport, managed to get back to Hong Kong though, and my partner picked me up at the airport and faked my way through being sober. I thought that lasted for about a day and a half, and I was just out of control after that short of a time, out of control. It was like my alcoholism went into hyperdrive. And my partner, you know, is now 2018, February of 2018. We've been together since 2002. He had enough. He said to me, I can't deal with this anymore. You're going to have to do this on your own and, you know, get out. And so I moved into a hotel, right near the apartment we were living in here in Hong Kong. And I had a spiral out of control living alone in that hotel for the next few days, till the point where he came and checked in on me, and I was a mess, and I had to be taken to the hospital. And then he asked me when I was at the hospital, he said, do you really want to do something about this? Do you really want to get better? Do you want to do it for yourself? And I said, yes. He said, then you need to go back and finish what you started at that rehab. And I said, okay. So I was back at that rehab within about a week from when I left. And I spent another little over a month there on my own dime, 100% me, because I wanted it. I wanted to get better. I wanted a solution. I didn't want to live like that anymore. And I didn't want to lose my husband. And I think back, you know, I was willing to kill myself. I was willing to jump off the balcony of the apartment in Shanghai because I didn't see any other way out. But, you know, it was the idea of losing my partner that really, I just guess, like, flipped something in me. And I wanted it not only to save my marriage, but to also, you know, save myself. And so I spent that next month or so there, and a couple revelations, I use that word loosely, revelations happened to me while I was there that last month. One thing that I had always heard about the higher power part of this program is that it can be anything or nothing. But you know, I from the very first beginnings of my AA in New York, I went to a meeting called High Noon at the LGBT Center down in the West Village one Sunday, and it's in the David Geffen auditorium there, and it's like a meeting. I mean, to me, it was a big meeting. I hear there's meetings like 2,000 people in LA and stuff, but I've never been to one of those. This meeting, though, for me was huge. It was like 300 people in this auditorium. And I had heard that concept that, you know, you can use the group of drunks as your higher power, the fellowship. And when I was at that meeting, I thought to myself about that. And I thought, you know, people got up and they passed a microphone around the room and ask people to, like, if they had a milestone, or if they were counting days, or they were celebrating a AA birthday, to, you know, announce it. And that went on, it seemed like, forever. And I thought to myself, wow, if you added up all the sobriety in this room, it's probably like 1,000 years of sobriety. That's pretty impressive. And when I was in rehab, I kind of reflected back on that. And when I was doing that, one day I thought to myself, well, yeah, but how does that work? Especially when it comes to the rest of this program, where, you know, it talks about like prayer and meditation in step 11. How am I going to make this program work for me there? Not being like a religious person. And I heard this person share, it was a counselor there who shared at the rehab, who said for them, you know, prayer is making a petition to something or someone, you know, in the religious sense, to a God. But, you know, prayer is a petition for help. And meditation is getting to a state of calmness where you can listen and understand. So it's like listening for the answers is what meditation is about. So he said for him, going to meetings and sharing was his version of praying. That was praying to him because he's asking for help. He's sharing his problems, asking for answers, looking for experience from other people in the fellowship for how they've found their sobriety. And so sharing is praying and sitting in meetings quietly, listening to others share about their experience, strength, and hope is his form of meditation. And I thought to myself, okay, that makes sense. I can make that work. And so when I actually started working the steps with when I got out after that final month and I came back to Hong Kong and went back to working my steps with Billy, my old timer sponsor, we started, you know, at step one and worked through, and you know, I came to believe that the fellowship was a power greater than myself, that the collective whole was stronger than any one single me. And I started using the method of substitution when I read the literature. Like anytime it said that G-O-D word, I didn't use group of drunks or great outdoors or good orderly direction or gift of desperation. I just substituted whenever it said God, I substituted the program, the fellowship, the steps, the principles. And I'd say 98% of the time, when I did that, the sentence, the paragraph, the chapter all still made perfectly good sense, at least to me. So it was working for me to do that, just substituting my version of a higher power, power greater than myself, into the literature. And I kind of like, I think I just, you know, they say willingness, open-mindedness, and honesty are the three essentials of recovery. First of all, I got honest with myself about that I really wanted to stop drinking for me, not because of other people pressuring me or hassling me or threatening me, that I really wanted it and that I wanted to live a better life that didn't involve alcohol. And then secondly, became willing to do what it took for that to happen and not just try, but to actually do. And then the final thing, the open-mindedness part, to take and run with the latitude that you're given in the program of AA, if you choose that program to work for your recovery. You're given the latitude to choose anything you want or nothing at all, the way I see it. You just can't choose yourself is the only caveat I've ever heard people say. Because self is what has been always my problem. You know, my sponsor likes to say this is a dis-ease, an uneasiness with self, a disease of self. We are generally characterized by people that are self-obsessed, selfish, self-pitying, self-sabotaging. And you can go on down the list. So, you know, when I come across things like, you know, what's God's will for me? Well, what's the will of the fellowship for me? They want me to stay sober, plain and simple. That's it. That's it. For me to stay sober one day at a time. But the idea that I can ever drink again has to be smashed. That, you know, that I didn't understand. I heard that one day at a time thing at first, and I thought to myself, well, that seems silly. But You know, the book clearly says the idea that you can ever drink like a normal person has to be smashed. That's the abstinence. And then how do I accomplish that? Well, I accomplish that one day at a time. Yeah, absolutely. So here in Hong Kong, when I got back, we didn't have a secular meeting. So I helped start one. Because I figured, you know, if I had struggled this much for this long, and, you know, like I said, I had been introduced to AA for the longest time. My liver doctor said, go to AA. You know, I had friends say, go to AA. You know, my partner said, why don't you try AA? And I was like, no way, AA. There's no G-O-D for me. I thought, you know, gosh, I can't believe that a city like this doesn't have a secular meeting. I got on the New York Intergroup website and was using the filter functions that they had on there. And I was like, wow, look at New York. They've got like, you know, every type of meeting imaginable. They got atheist meetings and they've got secular meetings and agnostic meetings and they've got gay meetings and they got straight meetings and they got, you know, like everything under the sun. And here in Hong Kong, it was like just pretty much traditional plain old meetings. So I also decided to help start an LGBTQ group here. So my point about that is I started trying to give back pretty much as soon as I got sober. And I have found that, you know, keeping the focus on others and off myself by doing service has helped keep me sober. The focus on service has really given my life purpose. I mean, I'm still not working. I literally smashed my career. I did so much damage to my reputation that I don't know that I could ever get back into that line of work again. But I don't really care. I have a different set of priorities in my life now. And the reward I get about helping others and being able to talk to LGBTQ youth, especially that are struggling, and to talk to other people who just do not have any desire to have religion or any of that kind of stuff spoon-fed to them. And approach this AA program from a completely secular point of view. If I can make someone else's journey a little bit faster to sobriety than mine was, you know, I think that's a great thing that I can help with, you know. But if it doesn't happen for them, you know, it's their journey, not mine. I can't make other people sober. Just like, you know, my first sponsor didn't make me sober. My second sponsor didn't make me sober. And my third sponsor, my current sponsor, my 41-year sober sponsor, he didn't make me sober. It was me and my open-mindedness, my willingness, and my honesty, finally, that led to my sobriety. And now that I have it, I don't want to let go of it. I'm holding on to it like a life preserver. You know, I'm holding on to my sobriety now the way I used to hold on to a bottle of vodka, with a death grip. It really has been the greatest gift in my life that I finally I don't know what else to call it. I just have kind of had a transformation. And it took a lot of different experiences, some aha moments. But I kind of filed them all away over the course of the time of this long period from 2003, when I first, I think there's something wrong, to 2017, when I was like, I think I need to be committed and locked up because I cannot fucking stay away from a bottle of booze if I'm a free man to walk around and wander into a liquor store. And that's what it took for me to clear my head long enough to actually start thinking about and looking at myself and my beliefs, my actions, my reactions over the course of my life, and come to terms with everything. And now that I've done that, and I continue to do that every day, because it is a daily reprieve based on working some principles like honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, courage, integrity, perseverance, love, understanding, tolerance, patience. You know, who can fault that? Those are all good things. And they've made me much happier. So, all right. I think I did enough damage to the time frame on the meeting. But you told me I could share as long as I wanted to. So anyway, thank you so much for inviting me to speak at this meeting. And very grateful because all of you help me stay sober every day. And with that, thanks, Marcia. I'll turn it back to you.